I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
And good morning. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, where the time is now 9:01, and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Actually, it's almost 9:03. I'm your host, Clayton Morgeridge. Our engineer is Judy Feistel. We call ourselves moles because we work underground to explore the hidden roots of the social order we live in, of which the mass media shows us only the glossy, manufactured surfaces, obscuring the machinery of deception and exploitation which keeps us enslaved to an unjust world order. The old mole was also Karl Marx's figure for the revolution that works unnoticed, underground, and pops up in world affairs at unexpected moments to set history on a radically new course. The Old Mole Collective works hard every week to bring you the best radical analysis available on the air anywhere. If you like what you hear, you can hear it again or recommend it to your friends by searching for the Old Mole Variety Hour on the KBOO website. That's kboo.fm. You can also like us on Facebook to get regular updates and follow us on Twitter. Well, today, of course, is Labor Day, so we're going to start off today's show with some commentary about workers. What is the position of the worker in this particular kind of society? What about the labor involved in being an activist working to make life better for workers and for all of us? Then later in the show, we'll be hearing about how capitalist agriculture has depleted the soil on which the labor of producing our food takes place. And we'll conclude the show with a book review, looking back at two novels by the great British writer Graham Greene. In a few minutes, the old mole's Todd Sloan will be here to discuss the labor of activism. But first, here is my commentary about what we are and should be celebrating on Labor Day.
On this Labor Day, let's stop and think a little about what we're supposed to be celebrating. It's a national holiday, so perhaps we should start by seeing what the Federal Department of Labor says. On its website, we find this. Labor Day, the first Monday in September, is a creation of the labor movement and is dedicated to the social and economic achievements of American workers. It constitutes a yearly national tribute to the contributions workers have made to the strength, prosperity, and well-being of the nation. End of quote. So it's a celebration of what workers have done for the nation. So who are these workers? According to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, a worker is a person who does a particular job to earn money. Now, this definition begs some interesting questions that are not asked or answered by the Department of Labor. First, since the worker is someone who does a job to earn money, he or she is doing it regardless of any desire for the activity or for the results, but essentially for the money. Well, why is the worker in the position of needing to work for money? To answer this question, we have to turn to a second question. Who is it that pays the worker money? It would have to be someone who does not need to work to earn money, but instead has money he can use to get others to work. That money is capital, and the owner of that money is the capitalist. So beginning from the very incomplete definition of worker found in the dictionary, we arrive at a definition that involves the worker's opposite, the capitalist. The reason workers need to work for money is that they have no capital, and they have no capital because capital is privately owned by capitalists. So workers can live only by selling their labor power to the owners of capital. We might ask further, what does the capitalist get by employing workers? The capitalist expects to be able to sell the results of the workers' labor for more than he has to pay them. In other words, workers produce more value than they receive in exchange for their labor. So by digging into the meaning of worker, we have come upon a bedrock form of social division, dividing our society into two radically unequal classes. those who have no access to the wealth needed to be productive, and those who have a monopoly on that wealth. Workers have no way to live but by selling the hours of their lives to capital. Capitalists have no way to maintain themselves as capitalists but by employing workers who can be made to produce more value than what the capitalist has to pay them. Now, how did society arrive at this division of the world's wealth between those who have it all, the top tenth of the top 1%, and those who have nothing except the ability to work? Well, let's consider how Donald Trump got his wealth. According to Samuel Stein, writing in Jacobin, Trump insists that he is a self-made man. Of course, he is not. His wealth came from his father's theft of labor, taxes, and land. Donald Trump has perfected these methods and accumulated even more wealth. His fortune is triply stolen by wage theft from the workers who build and maintain his projects, tax theft from the state that enables him, and land theft from the common spaces he encloses. Consider first how he steals from workers. Donald Trump's real estate business is premised on profit off of the labor of thousands of workers in construction, maintenance, and services. Each paycheck to each worker represents a small theft, the deduction of a portion of that worker's compensation for their boss's profits. But Trump has built on these everyday pilfers, increasing his fortune through straightforward wage theft. In order to build Trump Tower, to take just one example, his contractor hired 200 undocumented Polish workers for less than $5 an hour to demolish the asbestos-laden department store that had occupied the lot where he wanted to build the tower. They worked 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, with no overtime pay. Many of them were not even paid all of their paltry wages, and some did not get paid at all. They sued the contractor, and Trump stalled and denied until finally settling 16 years later. So in addition to the normal capitalist theft from workers that is built into the system, Trump steals from workers by not even paying them their contracted wages. Now, this is very common among capitalists, refusing to pay overtime, forcing workers to work off the clock, restaurant managers stealing tips, and so on. Slavery is another way of stealing the labor from workers, and it continues today in many places around the world, including in the United States. And we must not forget that the wealth of the U.S. and Great Britain that funded industrial development in the 19th century was created by labor stolen from people who had themselves been stolen and forced to pick cotton and sugarcane in the American South and the British Caribbean. That was how the unpaid labor of many millions of black slaves contributed, as the Department of Labor puts it, to the strength, prosperity, and well-being of the nation. As far as I have heard, we are not celebrating that contribution on Labor Day. The Jacobin piece by Samuel Stein goes on to detail how the Trumps, father and son, made a practice of shorting the state with tax breaks and subsidies gained by political influence, and of privatizing public space through eminent domain and, again, political cronyism. Just as the Trumps got rich off of public resources, so this capitalist nation acquired its land by appropriating it from its former native residents, exterminating most of them in the process. Howard Zinn tells of how railroad men in the 1800s gave money, shares of stock, and free railroad passes to congressmen and state legislators, and in return got millions in loans and millions of acres on which to lay their rails and which they could use for other profitable purposes. Native villages had been cleared away by the U.S. Army for the convenience of white settlers as well as the railroads. All this, then, is how the working class came to be the class of people dispossessed, not only of the earth's resources, but of the fruits of their own industry, the world they have built, leaving them, leaving us, dependent on the class of owners, that top tenth of the top 1%, to employ us to do whatever work will keep the system running and increasing their wealth. This is nothing to celebrate. In the process, of course, workers keep us all fed, clothed, and housed, or at least those of us who can afford to pay what capital charges for these services. There are also workers who do what they love or what they can to make the lives of others better, teachers and nurses, for example. But what we should be celebrating today is the potential of the working class to organize, not just for better pay and conditions of their labor from their employers, but to take back the conditions of their lives, to work for a world in which we own what we do and what we build and create. The day that the labor movement becomes a people's movement for such a world will really be a day to celebrate. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and families.
I want more than a paycheck, but what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home asbestosis and silicosis, round long black lung disease, and the radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and family.
And that's Sweet Honey in the Rock with More Than a Paycheck, following my commentary on Labor Day here on the Old Mole Variety Hour. I spoke of the potential of the working class to organize, to take back the conditions of our lives. This involves the work of activism, and it's not done for wages paid by capital. Here to talk about things activists need to keep in mind as we engage in the labor needed to reclaim our world is Todd Sloan. Todd.
Thank you, Clayton. Activism can be fruitfully understood as what's called a community of practice, a domain in which personal identities, roles, and ways of getting things done are all interwoven in a systematic way. In honor of progressive and radical activists and the labor they perform, I want to share a partial inventory of the labor of activism viewed as a community of practice. This is based in part on the work of a small Portland collective known as the Cascadia Center for Social Ecology, of which I'm a member. You can find it on Facebook, and which is dedicated to making the work of activists more effective and more enjoyable. So the following list can be seen as things worth reflecting on or attending to as aspects of the labor of activism. First of all, there are meetings, lots of them, each of which includes, for example, finding a space to meet, inviting people to come to the meeting, reminders to come to the meeting, welcoming and greeting people, setting up the space, preparing food to share, waiting for stragglers, checking in and introductions, setting the agenda, doing the work of the meeting, attending to process issues, timekeeping, vibes watching, making decisions according to some method or other, holding people accountable for tasks they've volunteered for, taking notes, documentation, dissemination of notes, and then finally checking out, closing, choosing next meeting time, and cleaning up. All that goes into almost every meeting activists are involved in. Each of these is a form of labor, organized human creativity devoted to an end, usually done without concern for monetary compensation. Then there are various forms of leadership, which are also forms of labor, usually done by members of a collective or team, rather than by a single individual. There's the work of vision, which is creating an inspiring perspective on the future. The work of delegation, linking resources to needs and finding effective roles for group members. The work of coordination, ensuring that communication flows between groups and individuals. Facilitation, helping groups achieve effective decision-making. Mediation, helping opposing parties resolve differences. The work of rhetoric, communicating ideas and values so as to build excitement and agreement. Expertise, specialized knowledge of a particular practice. Diplomacy, capacity to translate and articulate diversity. Memory, holding the history and skills that create continuity over time. Guidance, teaching, mentoring, all of these helping others to develop leadership capacities. So as we see, the work of leadership and grassroots activism is an amazingly complex process. Then there's the work related to growing in numbers and power, getting the story out in the media or by canvassing, recruiting new members, writing brochures and pamphlets, fundraising, seeking donations, grant writing to fund projects. There's the orientation and training of new members. There's organizing new chapters of the organization. Attending to self-care to prevent burnout. Using art and music and theater to convey the message. Learning the history of the movement itself. And studying strategies and tactics that have worked in the past. Finally, the thing that is the most visible part of activism is the conducting of actions themselves, campaigns, marches, protests, but all of the other work we've mentioned so far is behind the scenes and done usually without much recognition for those who do it. We also can't forget all the emotional and interpersonal labor of working through despair and sustaining hope and optimism. Finally, there's the labor of movement building, which includes building understanding and trust between members of related political projects, forming coalitions to plan events, hammering out a common vision across different causes and their struggles, sharing resources, equipment, space, and funding, celebrating successes, keeping the spark alive, and rekindling collaborations across groups when the spirit has faded. Everywhere I go, I meet people who are doing this labor of love we call activism, and most of them also express a yearning for broader collaboration for doing the work of movement building, for a more united front in the struggle for social justice. It happens that Portland now has an opportunity for movement building, a new one, for what could be called a public home place for grassroots groups representing marginalized and oppressed communities, indigenous communities and people of color, LGBTQ people and youth, to come together, to understand each other's movements, build trust, and prepare for collective action. This new opportunity is called the Social Justice Action Center, which is launching its first fundraiser today. Social Justice Action Center, known as SJAC, is a space, a building formerly housing the Red and Black Cafe at 400 Southeast 12th, a space for meetings, events, workshops, exhibitions, films, readings, and especially for movement-building processes. SJAC recently incorporated with a board and an advisory council consisting of leaders from various oppressed communities and other marginalized groups. And SJAC needs your energy and material support. To learn more, visit sjacpdx.org, which you can also find on Facebook, Social Justice Action Center. Your support will be simultaneously a blow against gentrification by keeping the building in the hands of the movement rather than developers, and a contribution to the essential possibility of coming together to do the labor of activism for social justice. Happy Labor Day.
And thank you, Todd. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO, your community-sponsored radio station. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Later in the show, our book mole, Larry Bolden, will be here to talk about Graham Greene's novel, The Quiet American. But right now, we're going to turn to another way in which the commons, what should belong to all of us, has been appropriated by capital, and that's the way agribusiness has depleted the soil in which our food is grown. Here's Bill Resnick to talk with Diana Donlan.
Diana Donlan, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Diana Donlan directs the Food and Safety Program for the Center for Food Safety. Last year, Diana wrote for the center a report, Soil and Carbon, Soil Solutions to Climate Problems. Diana Donlan, it seems to me that the climate crisis and global warming, also the water crisis and running out of fresh, clean water around the world, and the food crisis, that much of the food we eat is near without nutrients, these deep problems get lots of attention. They're pretty well known. But fast-worsening degradation of the planet's soil, it's talked about nearly exclusively in a few academic, scientific circles. Organic farming people talk about it. Yet all of these deep problems are linked. In fact, as your report points out, if we, humanity, can reverse soil degradation, then we will substantially reduce greenhouse gas emissions, we will greatly reduce water scarcity, and we will grow much more nutritious food. Before discussing why that's true, first, I think we have to talk about soil degradation. It's happening all over the planet for the last 150 years, and it's now very, very quickly worsening. What's happening?
Well, thanks, Bill. Soil degradation has actually been going on for centuries, but we've accelerated it in the last 150 years. And humans have always known that there's some sort of relationship between soil fertility and food production, obviously, but it's only been in recent history that that understanding of soil productivity has been understood to be related to the amount of organic matter or carbon in the soil. And now that we realize that, we have a tremendous opportunity before us because the amount of carbon on our planet is actually fixed. It's just a question, really, of distribution. So we know that there's way too much carbon in our atmosphere, and our atmosphere is obviously overwhelmed.
And it's warming as a result.
And it's warming as a result. But I think a lot of people are surprised to learn that we're deficient in our soils, and that that carbon that's in the soil in a solid form is actually missing.
It's been taken out then in some ways. By what? Modern agriculture and deforestation and all of those things?
All those things contribute to it. So deforestation, erosion, clear cutting, the amount of what's called compaction, which is, you know, heavy machinery squishing the soil, paving over our soils. We really have treated our soils poorly. We don't appreciate them the same way maybe we appreciate water and some of our other natural resources. We treat soil like dirt. And the very general distinction between soil and dirt is that soil is a living system. And as a living system, it needs to be fed. If you think of soil as the skin of the earth, then you think your skin needs to be covered and it needs to be protected. And what nature does is when we leave nature to her own devices, you never see bare soil in nature. Every little side of the road, nature will grow something. But we come along and we're constantly pulling up all the weeds, tearing down the trees, removing the vegetation, and exposing the soil microbial life to temperature extremes, extremes of heat, extremes of cold, wind. All these things assault the life in the soil and make it very difficult for the soil to carry out its many functions.
Let's talk about two of those things in addition to the ones that you talked about, like compaction and cutting down the forests and plowing things up. There's pesticides also take their toll, do they not, on microbes and insects, all of those processes that keep soil healthy?
Sure. It's harder to say definitively which pesticides compromise the soil activity, but there's no question that things like Roundup and glyphosate harm soil microbial life. In fact, they're learning just now that that can have an adverse impact at very low dosage. So when you kill those microorganisms that carry out all these functions, it just becomes harder for the soil to do things like hold water, which is one of its primary functions.
What about the ways in which carbon used to be just returned to the soil in natural processes like grasslands? Now we plow up those ancient grasslands or even almost any area, the forests, and the grain and the stalks and the corn cobs and everything, everything's taken away. Nothing is returns to the soil. That must also be one of the major sources of the degradation of soils.
In the United States, you know, the whole middle of the country was covered at one time by prairie, and that's where the great bison herds roamed. And we have destroyed about 97% of the American prairie, which was this diversified grassland ecosystem. We only have about 3% of it left. So imagine all that carbon that was released into the atmosphere as that process took place. And what happens is when you take that carbon, which was in a solid form in the soil, and release it so that it becomes a gas up in the atmosphere, and then there's nothing growing down below, it becomes very hard for the cycle to continue. So as I mentioned earlier, this is all a question of rebalancing the system. Carbon isn't inherently bad. It's just a question of where it is. So we need to get more of it back into the soil. Nature does this, as I mentioned, by having systems that are diverse, and we have a lot of monocultures in our industrial agriculture system. And that's not good for the soil life either, because it's like feeding a steady diet of the same thing all the time. The microorganisms living in the soil, they need a variety of food sources, not just corn and soy.
This is KBU Radio FM, Bill Resnick talking to Diana Donlan of the Center for Food Safety. She directs the Food and Climate Program for the center. Diana, we've talked about the soil degradation, and in fact, maybe we should say a word about the vast loss of soil in the Great Plains. Some of the soil used to be like 12 foot thick. Now it's like 3 or 4 foot thick, and in some areas of the country, all the soils have disappeared, like in Washington State and the Palouse. That's my understanding.
Well, globally, we've lost about 50 to 70% of the original carbon stock of cultivated soils. So it's very important to draw the distinction between the soils that we manage as humans and the soils that Mother Nature manages. So the soils that in wildlands are in balance, it's just the ones that we manage through our agricultural system. And we're realizing that tillage is very detrimental. So you hear a lot now, even in industrial agriculture, of a move towards no-till and increased cover cropping. And cover cropping is a great start, because if you've ever flown across the country and looked out the window and you see just vast expanses of bare dirt, that is oxidizing carbon. So even if you have an industrial system, but you are planting a crop to keep it covered, to keep the soil covered when you're not growing something that you're going to process, you're helping keep the soil alive, because otherwise it's like not feeding the soil for months at a time.
And you're allowing it to be blown away.
Exactly.
And eroded. If you get a storm and the water runs on this bare soil, it's in the rivers in no time.
Sure. Soil is really important for our water system. So what happens when you have this erosion and you have this compaction and all these different things, what's called effective rainfall is reduced. So when it rains, you really want that water to percolate back into the ground and recharge our aquifers. So there's a certain amount of water on our planet that you see in rivers and you see in lakes and so forth, but there's a lot more that's held in the soil as soil moisture. That water is filtered by the soil and it's held by the soil, and it has a cooling effect on our temperature. But when the soil structure is damaged by tillage, what's called the soil aggregates, which are little pockets of air, are compressed, and that doesn't allow the rain to infiltrate into the soil. So what happens when it does rain is the water sheets off, and that rain isn't effective. So it could rain a normal amount of rainfall, say that you're in an area where the average rainfall is 25 inches. You could get that 25 inches of rain per year, and not very many of those inches would be percolating back into the soil because the soil structure is damaged. Most of that rain is sheeting off, causing flooding. So now we see with climate change this kind of pendulum swinging wildly from not enough rain to too much rain. So you see flooding all the time. Well, a lot of that flooding has to do with the fact that we aren't slowing the water down. We aren't sinking it back into the ground. It's just coming faster and faster and going right back into the ocean with a lot of sediment.
With a lot of sediment, yeah. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland. Bill Resnick here talking to Diana Donlan of the Center for Food Safety. She directs the Food and Climate Program. We talked about how rebuilding soil carbon would greatly reduce the water crisis, keeping the water on the land and, in fact, percolating slowly and providing more for reservoirs all year round. We also talked about why nutrition would be better because the microbes would be producing, in healthy soil, the microbes themselves produce nutrients for the plants, which then go into the food. What we didn't talk about is global warming. Tell us why rebuilding the soils would have a substantial effect on global warming.
Well, I'm sure that radio listeners have heard of this number, 350. And there's a big organization, an international organization, headed up by Bill McKibben called 350.org. And 350 is the number that climate scientists have told us that we should not exceed. And that's the amount of carbon that's in our atmosphere. Well, we have already exceeded that number. We're at over 400 parts per million. It's around 403 or something like
that. Of carbon dioxide.
Of carbon dioxide. Yeah. So even if miraculously somehow, some way, we stopped burning fossil fuels planet-wide tomorrow, we would still have this excess carbon in the atmosphere, and we have to draw that carbon down. Now, Mother Nature has just the most elegant and ingenious way to do that, and it's called photosynthesis. And photosynthesis is the process that actually removes carbon dioxide from the atmosphere circulation and draws it down into plant matter. And as much as 40% of what's photosynthesized by a plant goes through the roots into the soil. So the other 60% the plant is using to, you know, grow stems and leaves and so forth. But you'll remember from your elementary school science class that plants draw in CO2, they release that oxygen and we get to breathe it. And then they take that carbon and they use it. So this is how we can begin to draw down atmospheric CO2 and address global warming is by increasing photosynthetic activity on our planet. NASA is doing all these amazing, you know, satellite projections around the world, and they actually are able to show, Bill, this is really incredible. Through their satellites, in the northern hemisphere, we have deciduous forests. And these are trees that leaf out in the spring. And you can actually see on a planetary basis the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere go down when it's spring because there's so much photosynthetic activity taking place in the northern part of the planet. So our goal as a society, as a global society, should be we want the carbon inputs from photosynthesis to exceed the carbon losses, okay? So if we can increase the amount of photosynthetic activity, and it sounds simplistic and it sounds unscientific, but if you think about how much we've destroyed on this planet in terms of not only rainforest, but also temperate forest, deciduous forest, and add that up with the figure that I mentioned earlier, 97% of the prairie in this country being plowed under, that's a lot less photosynthetic activity going on this planet. So for people at home, every little thing you plant in your garden, it's important. You just want to have a diversity of plants in your garden. You want to keep your soil covered. You want to try and mimic nature to the best extent possible. And you want to have what are called perennials. And perennials are the plants that live year after year. And those are better at storing carbon because they have longer roots. So the carbon is pushed down further into the soil profile and it's more stable. What happens with annuals, which a corn plant, for instance, would be most of our agriculture, our commodity agriculture, is in annual production. You pull up the plant or the plant dies at the end of the season and those roots go up and that carbon goes back up into the atmosphere. So we want to encourage more perennial forms of agriculture because that is a more stable form of carbon.
There really are answers. We have trillions and trillions and trillions of little machines all over the planet that are feeding carbon, that are desperate for life. That is, these little seeds grow and they become plants, and these plants like to live like all life. And they take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and put it into the ground. Trillions. And here we are spending huge amounts of money trying to develop clean coal so that we're not. It's all absurd, it seems to me. What we have to do is use all those trillions of plants and add trillions more. That is, encourage their growth by various sorts of agricultural methods and reforestation. If that's wrong, tell me if it's wrong. But if not, we'll
We still need to reduce our fossil fuel emissions.
There's right.
Absolutely no question about it. And our campaign is not saying that we don't need to do that. We just need to add more tools to our toolbox. What we're saying is we need to do both. So we need to simultaneously stop putting so much CO2 and other gases up into the atmosphere and simultaneously draw down what is already up there in excess. So just to give you some sense of how large a reservoir soil is, the soil carbon pool right now, even with its deficit, is about 3 times larger than the atmospheric pool of carbon. So the atmosphere really can't hold as much carbon as the soil can.
That's incredible. It seems to me that we fully know what has to be done. That is, keep the carbon in the ground and restore our soils and do many other things, change our diets some, have transport that's electric and use renewable energy, all of these things. Restoring our soils, it seems to me, is extremely important. Let's talk about why is it so difficult to move towards regenerating and rebuilding our soils? What's going on?
Well, the people that started the climate movement, very emissions-focused, industrialized countries such as our own, and agriculture was really not considered. And, you know, we're trying to bring a systems approach to this problem and really, instead of seeing nature as our adversary, enlist nature's help, because nature has tremendous capacity for self-renewal. So if we start rebuilding soil carbon, which we now know how to do, we can start moving these systems in a way that's regenerative, that have all these co-benefits of increased water retention, of increased food security. Even if we didn't have a climate problem, we would still need to rebuild soil carbon for our food and water security. So this is just a no-lose proposition. It's a win-win-win proposition to rebuild soil carbon. But what that awareness has been missing, soil during the 20th century was looked at as a chemistry set, and we didn't really realize that it was this living system with all these symbiotic relationships between the roots and these specialized fungi like mycorrhizae and all these earthworms and nematodes and so on and so forth. We just looked at it as sort of a medium to add chemicals to and prop plants up. That awareness is changing. People are starting to study soil science now. We now have new tools, but it's really the last frontier. We know more about the stars overhead, I think it was Leonardo da Vinci who said this, than we do about the soil processes under our feet. So it's really a great time to be involved with soil science and have a new appreciation for soil. And I'd love to have your listeners look at a short film that we showed at the recent climate conference in Paris. They can go to YouTube, and the name of the 4-minute film, which we had narrated by Michael Pollan, is called Soil Solutions to Climate Problems. We have it in Chinese, and we have it in French and Finnish, and we're getting it in more languages, but it really lays out this opportunity in a very short film, and we encourage people to watch it and share it with other people so that this soil carbon opportunity and avenue for hope is more widely known.
Diana Donlan, what we haven't talked about is the struggle on the land now for agroecology principles, and agribusiness, various kinds of agribusiness interests are loath to change. They've got a profit model and they just want to keep going, and particularly around the world, there are real predators who are destroying land very, very rapidly, like in the Amazon. It seems to me that becomes even more important to stop that and move towards regenerative and building soils. I'm afraid we don't have time, but maybe we can do that sometime soon. So I just want to thank you, Diana Donlan of the Center for Food Safety. Look up that YouTube short video. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Bill. It's been my pleasure.
Solid rock into silt and sand and clay, but erosion, erosion, it carries them away. Humus forms when living things die and then decay, but erosion, erosion, it carries it away. Erosion takes away the soil we need to help things grow. Soil so good, if I could.
And that's erosion. Composed and performed by science teacher David Newman. We'll link to his website when we post today's show at kboo.fm. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. Well, Graham Greene was one of Great Britain's most widely read novelists in the 20th century, and one of his works, The Quiet American, bears very much on our own history. Here's Larry Bolden to talk about it.
Good morning to you on this day of celebrating American workers. I want to talk to you this morning about two fairly short Graham Greene novels, a very serious one, The Quiet American, and a very intentionally comedic one, Our Man in Havana. To speak just briefly of the second, which was made famous in a film version of the same name starring Alec Guinness in one of his dry and excellent comedies, Greene likes to make fun of spies and especially spies who are spying on spies. His primary target in this novel is the British intelligence network, but he is equally contemptuous of American and Russian intelligence gathering institutions. Guinness plays the role of James Wormold, a vacuum cleaner retailer in Cuba, where the electrical power is so unreliable that selling vacuums is a very questionable enterprise. Wormold's wife has left him, and he's doing his best to keep up with the rather extravagant tastes of his devoutly Catholic 16-year-old girl. Almost by accident, he is recruited into the British M16, into which Greene himself was recruited in 1941. Wormhold is paid extra for each new recruit he brings into the fold, and soon he's making up names of agents to pad his income. When he senses that his fictitious reports are losing steam with his bosses in London, he hand-draws parts of the atomic vacuum cleaner he sells in his shop and sends them to his superiors, claiming they are drawings of very secret Cuban missile installations going up in the hills around Havana. Though this novel was published in 1958, it may seem prescient given the events of just a few years later. While his network of fictitious recruits continues to grow larger and larger, he is pressed to get actual photographs of the installations. As the comedic elements of the story roll out, making Greene's point that the spy networks will believe most anything their local sources claim, the reader is treated to more and more of Greene's skepticism about so-called intelligence gathering. It's a quick and interesting read, and I would suggest that you read the book before seeing the film version, though both are funny and highly entertaining. The Quiet American is a much more serious work published in 1955. As is pointed out by almost all commentators, the title itself is a joke. Among the press and diplomatic personnel in Vietnam during the last days of the French occupation, the claim was that the only quiet American is a dead American. Thomas Fowler is a British journalist in Saigon. He's a heavy drinker and an opium smoker living with a Vietnamese mistress. But in most ways, his voice is the moral voice, the voice of sanity in this sometimes darkly humorous, sometimes deadly serious novel. The anti-hero of the novel, Alden Pyle, announces his intention to vie for the affections of Fuang, Fowler's beautiful but shallow mistress. Green mentions over and over the innocence of the Americans, especially Pyle, but the meaning of innocence for Green and Fowler is a peculiar one. As Robert Stone says in his introduction to the novel, quote, "To be innocent is to be bumptious and stupid, rude, provincial, inconsiderate, well-intentioned but at the same time conscienceless and murderous," close quote. Pyle is an American CIA agent who has learned all he knows about foreign countries and foreign policies from books he studied at Harvard. Fowler says that his first instinct was to protect Pyle. Quote, "It never occurred to me there was a greater need to protect myself. Innocence always calls mutely for protection when we would be so much wiser to guard ourselves against it. Innocence is like a dumb leper who has lost his bell, wandering the world, meaning no harm. He, Pyle, was impregnably armored by his good intentions and his ignorance. What's the good? He'll always be innocent. You can't blame the innocent. They are always guiltless. All you can do is control them or eliminate them. Innocence is a kind of insanity," close quote. In another section of the book, Fowler says of Pyle, "I never knew a man who had better motives for all the trouble he caused," close quote. Fowler, like Green, is old and cynical, with at best a tenuous grip on life. When he loses his beloved Huang to Pyle, he gives into the most nihilistic of existential rants, and the bitterness he expresses seems to disclose an equal bitterness in Green. While the love triangle in the novel and the senseless exploits of Pyle are meant to be humorous, there's a dark seriousness that broods over this book. Rather than telling you more of the story or quoting more passages, let me end by quoting Stone in the introduction. Quote, "The quiet American's metaphorical power is undeniable. It carries a weight of truth that America and American readers will have to live with. Green witnessed the beginning of a terrible mistake, a deadly mistake, the mistake of a great power armed to the teeth, attempting to inflict its will in a part of the world to whose language and gestures it was tone deaf," close quote. Graham Greene is one of the finest writers of the 20th century, and these two little novels are excellent examples of the many forms his literature took. I've been talking about Graham Greene's Our Man in Havana and The Quiet American. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
World, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. No, no, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
And that is The Eve of Destruction by Barry McGuire, following up on Larry Bolden's discussion of The Quiet American about the Vietnam War. And that's going to conclude the Old Mole Variety Hour for today. If there's any part of this show you would like to hear again, search for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's website, kboo.fm, and you'll find links to this show and many others. Today's show will be available in a day or two. It'll have links to some of the sources that we used and other information. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter for announcements of upcoming shows and links to those that have been posted. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer today has been Judy Feistel. Thanks to Todd Sloan for his commentary on the labor of activism, to Bill Resnick and Diana Donlan for their discussion of the state of the soil that keeps us alive, and to Larry Bolden for his discussion of Graham Greene. Tune in again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Old Mole's Underground Perspective. And stay tuned to KBOO.